I think, however, that some, at least, had descended from above, possibly even come from beyond the wall of fire which bounds the spirit plane. These new reinforcements quickly turned the tide of war. The elementals of the first division were swept from sight. The elementals of the second division followed them. The white spirits also rushed down in pursuit, nor did they appear to attack the evil mortals, being content apparently to leave us to deal with them. But heartened by this sight, we rushed in more fiercely and broke through the enemy, and, on seeing this, the astral men of the second division fled back to their own dens. We now devoted our attention to shattering the last remnants of the enemy. Immediately the lack of cohesion became manifest. All attempts at a concerted rearguard action were abandoned. They scattered in every direction, some flying on to the dream plane, others attempting to hide among the newly slain, while numbers turned and dashed wildly down from crag to crag into the crevices of the second division. Nor did we give them any rest. They had plagued the astral plane and hampered our work too long. Wherever we found them, we drove them over the precipices. In and out among the newly slain we dashed, hunting down the enemy, till at length I cried enough. And we swept back through the plane of the dreamers. Strange to say, the enemy seemed to stand out among the others. One might almost say that they bore the mark of Cain upon them. We passed among the dreamers as we had among the newly slain, hunting only the enemy, and when we found them we drove them across the earth plane into the second division. At length I stayed the fight and, on the edge of the earth plane, where it merged into the dream plane, I spoke the strong words that bind, and when I had finished I bade all the army repeat these words after me. In the name of God Most High, and by the might of Christ and His apostles, by the saints above and the angelic sword, we bid you lie in the realms of night. Lie there and come no more till your astral bodies melt and fall. Then may the Lord remember you. The astral plane is free of them at last. Doubtless there are many who have escaped, and new ones will arise, but for the time their opposition is broken. Remember this, gentlemen, there is a time for mercy and time for justice, and often justice is the greatest mercy. For, as in this case, by dealing out stern justice we save thousands from a like fate. These will tempt no more. We were silent for a space, but to some of us it seemed that the officer was inclined to be ruthless in the extreme. Our hearts sank at the awful doom and gasped at what we almost felt was his presumption. At length one man voiced the feelings of several. "Sir, I boldly ask, are you justified in such strong measures? It is for God alone to judge and doom men to hell. For, to be blunt, your spell mean that, for if they cannot climb from out the second division, they must fall to hell. By what authority, I ask?" The officer smiled grimly. "By the same authority that made me founder of this organization. By the power of my will, and if any wish to strive against it, I challenge him here and now. But if you mean by what right I do this thing, meaning how can I justify myself, I answer this: in every society of men there exists some system of law and order, suited to their condition, and to enforce the laws of the community, penalties exist. Sometimes these are inflicted by one man in the name of all, sometimes the people themselves inflict the penalties. Here too, law exists, and evildoers must be restrained lest the innocent should suffer. As head of this society, who has more right than I to inflict such penalties as are necessary? But further, not every person here knows how to inflict punishment suitable to such offenses, for take note, the object of this spell is not so much to punish the wrongdoer as to protect others from him. And further, except a man have a strong will, tempered like steel in the fire of adversity, he cannot impress his will on others, nor even focus the united will of many upon one object, as I did in this case. If, then, any man considers I have done wrong, he is free. Let him go where he will, no one shall bid him stay." But no one moved, and so the officer dismissed us. RLW paused, and then added, answering a thought of mine, "The soldiers had no difficulty in hearing the second spell, if so you like to call it. It was a thought, and as he desired all to know it, they heard it. What the first spell was I cannot say, but I presume it was couched in more occult terms than the second one, which was intended to focus the willpower of the whole army upon the object he wished to attain. Chapter 14, A Death in Hospital. As soon as I got outside, I looked up the other private who had told me he had died in hospital. We then went round to a little office I have at headquarters, where he gave me the following narrative. I was struck by a fragment of shrapnel, which cut through into my lung. There were several other pieces in different parts of my body, but they wouldn't have mattered. I turned queer, and all went black. When I awoke, I was in a hospital behind the firing line. I was in awful pain, and couldn't help groaning. Doctors and nurses seemed to flit through my dreams, but I have little clear recollection of this period. Next thing I remember was being borne into another room, I suppose an operating theater, where I was chloroformed. Now, strange to say, almost at once my mind grew clearer and, instead of losing complete consciousness, I found myself floating in the air, but fully alive to what was going on. My body was stretched on the operating table, but what interested me far more than the actual operation was the new point of view from which I was able to observe things. Men and inanimate objects looked different from what I remembered them. The men seemed to be double, to have a light figure inside a grey form. Sometimes the light figure shone beyond the grey, but more often it seemed embedded in it. Moreover, these figures varied in colour. Some were very beautiful, and seemed to be shot with rays of green and purple, yellow, blue, and pink. Others were a steady yellow, while a few were an ugly orange-brown or angry red. While I was still speculating on what these changes meant, I heard one of the doctors say, "It's no use. Better take him back. If we go on, he'll die on the table. Poor fellow. His number's up," remarked another man, who seemed to be arranging bandages. I was vaguely conscious that my body was being carried back to the ward, and drifted along by its side. Once back in the ward, they put a screen round my bed, and everyone except the nurse left me. Suddenly I thought, I'll go back into my body, and next moment I felt crushed and pressed by a great weight. I heard a scream. It was my own voice. Consciousness seemed to be slipping from me. Now I realized that I was dying, and I didn't want to go. My will seemed to gather itself together, and my whole physical body shook with convulsions. An awful pain seemed to rend me, but I distinctly remember struggling up into a sitting position. That must have been my last effort. I seemed to collapse, and lost consciousness. Then once more I found myself floating over my body. Suddenly a strong wind caught me and whirled me round like a bit of thistle down. I thought I was a boat in a raging storm, and even felt the rope which moored me to the shore. The fury of the storm increased, and the cord snapped. Instantly I was whirling amid waves of darkness. Up and down, to and fro I danced, till at length daylight appeared. The dark storm waves seemed to pile up into one huge wave and hurl me onto a rocky shore. As they did so, I heard someone reading the funeral service, but I had no time to attend to it. I scrambled quickly to my feet and looked round at the sea, but there was none, simply the same strange ground as that which lay in front of me. I was puzzled at the time, and still am, but did not stay still for very long. I remembered the story of Pilgrim's Progress, and how Pilgrim had to cross a river on the further bank of which lay the New Jerusalem. That was the only bit of information I had about the next world, but I took the hint, and set out to seek it. I am still seeking it. He paused, and then went on. I walked straight ahead, and the ground seemed to rise upwards, till by degrees it changed into rolling downs with gorse, juniper, and such small shrubs. I, RLW, said, "Oh, the dream plane." He took no notice of my remark, but went on. I was feeling terribly lonely, oh, not a sign of life, not an animal, much less a man, and I sat down and wept. Yes, I know it sounds womanish, but I wept. And as I sat there weeping, strange forms began to flit across the downs. At first they were dull and shadowy, but by degrees they grew clear and substantial, and suddenly I gave a shout of delight, for there I saw my mother and father. He didn't see me, strange to say, and floated away in spite of all I could do to detain him, but at my first cry of "Mother," She turned towards me. For a moment I thought she was blind, for her eyes were shut, but in another moment they opened, and we knew each other. We had a tremendous lot to say, but, strange to relate, we hardly touched on my death. We preferred to talk over old times, especially my boyhood days. Suddenly she broke off, and a wail of sorrow rose in the air. "I must go," she cried, and turned and fled. I screamed, "Don't go yet!" But rapidly she moved away. I rushed after her, but she went even more swiftly. I stumbled, fell, sprang up, and fell again. She was gone. I rushed on, frantic with grief, heeding nothing, intent only on finding her once more. Darkness had taken the place of the twilight, but in spite of it, my surroundings seemed new and strange. Instead of rocks or downs, trees and buildings loomed up amid the gloom. The sound of weeping fell upon my ears. I heard my mother's voice. I was outside their house. I recognized it, despite the gloom, and the shadowy, unsubstantial form which it now seemed to have. I followed her voice, and through the very walls I passed into their room. She was sitting up in bed, calling my name, and crying bitterly. My father was doing his best, in a man's clumsy way, to comfort her. I went to her and put my arm round her neck and kissed her, but she neither saw nor felt. "Why is it we can see these mortals, but they cannot see or even hear us?" Without waiting for me, RLW, to reply, he went on. After a while I could bear the sight no longer and wandered away. Through familiar streets I passed, and slowly I drifted towards what must have been the place where my body lay. I found myself within sound of guns. The roar of battle grew around me, and it was there I met the young officer and the other chap with whom you found me. I saw men fighting, but I knew my fighting days were over. Truth to tell, for some time I thought they were living, perhaps some were. But by degrees I realized many were just as I was. However, I felt no call to join in, and it was then that a group of soldiers came up and told me about this club. So we agreed to go along with them, and soon after we fell in with your band and witnessed the battle between your two parties. You know the rest, but now, in return for my death story, he smiled at the phrase, perhaps you'll explain things to me. Above all, is there a golden city of Zion, or is that a fable? So I told him briefly what life on this side was like, and added, the golden city of Zion I do not know, because I think it is still a long way off, but I hope someday to see it. But in the next plane to this, the spirit plane, are many beautiful golden cities, I understand, and if you reach these you will find that they will more than repay you for the arduous journey. So I left him in charge with several men with whom I thought he would be in sympathy. Rex stopped for a moment, and H.J.L. spoke. Time to be off, Jack. So saying goodbye to all, I returned to Earth. Chapter 15, Christmas Day on the Astral Plane. December 24th to 25th, 1917, as I came to the door of their house I found the three on the doorstep. A happy Christmas, they said together, and R.L.W. added, it's a good thing you weren't here early, for if you had been you would have found the house empty. We've just come back from church. We were now in the house, and as we sat down, RLW continued. Yes, Mother wanted to go to church, as it was Christmas Day, so we went to the midnight mass in Ypres Cathedral. Mother. It was a splendid service, and I enjoyed the singing immensely. JW. It was choral, then? RLWO. Yes, and there was a procession too. The last time I was in that cathedral was when I was on Earth. It was a sad picture, I assure you. There was a huge congregation, and, do you know, we felt we were in communion with those on Earth. It was a strange sensation, and difficult to describe, but there was no doubt of it. JW. What time do you follow here? RLW. Greenwich. We are used to it. Even French time was only a few minutes different. But it is only on occasions like this that we trouble about time. You see, we desire to synchronize with men on Earth, and therefore have to make our time fit theirs. We unite our prayers with Earth folk, and so become for a moment caught within the circle of time, but only for a short time, so long as we wish to be united with them. JW. Being Anglican, Why did you not go to one of our services? Any special reason? Our LW mother wanted to see a fine service, and I thought I would like to see Ypres under happier circumstances, and as HJL did not mind one way or the other, we went there. HJL, I wonder how many people realize how closely the unseen world is linked with the material. Very few, I expect, despite their constant repetition of the sentence the Communion of Saints. I think, however, they should have written it the Communion of Souls, for we are mostly far from saints as yet. We were all silent for a moment, and then I said, how do you propose to spend Christmas Day here? Yes, I was a bit late getting off to bed. Christmas presents, etc., you know. RLW, well, this is my program. There is no Christmas dinner for us here, so our amusements are mostly mental. 12.45 to 1.30, midnight mass. Till you leave we shall be together here. Then I shall go to the festivities at headquarters. The soldiers are having various forms of entertainment. There is a popular concert in one room, amateur theatricals in another, dancing in a third. The officer has allowed invitations to be sent out to members of the women's organization. Your old friend, Sister Maria, belongs to that, by the way. You see, there is a special organization to deal with women. I've spoken to you about the nunnery of Saint Benedict in one of my recent talks. I must give you a chapter on the subject one day. Well, quite a number have accepted and are coming, I understand. As you know, we usually keep our men away from the fair sex, but an occasional meeting will do good rather than harm. They have arranged a dance. I suspect it will not be the success they imagine it will be. It's too physical an amusement. Still, that's their affair. Some of the arty crafty people are coming down and are going to present everyone with gifts of their own handiwork. I shall appreciate that largely. But I'm afraid most of the men will find their things a bit too arty for their tastes. Then there is a draughts tournament and a chess ditto. HJL is going to that. Rather rough luck on his opponents, isn't it? There are many other side shows besides. Well, I shall look in at all that's going on. I shall not go to any more services, though there are plenty to choose from. After leaving headquarters, I am going to a real miracle play, the Nativity. It is to be given in one of the medieval divisions of this plane, at about 11 a.m. Earth time. It's in the period of about 1450, I understand, and will be in the open air. Let me finish. These plays are fairly long, so I shan't wait to the end, but I shall go and see some Yuletide revels of the 17th century, see one of the advantages of being dead, and of knowing your way about here. After that I don't know whether I shall go back to early Saxon pre-Christian times, and see how they kept Yuletide, or whether I shall go to a pantomime. Rather different, eh? Anyway, I shall end up at the opera. There is a new one which is to be brought out for the first time tonight. It's called The Three Magi. It deals, of course, with the whole story of the Nativity, but there's a magical and occult touch which would appeal to you. J.W. Who's it by? RLW Mozart. He's in the spirit plane, and the opera has already been produced there. One of the spirit beings, who works on this plane like HJL does, brought it down to us. JW, I wish they'd bring it down to Earth, RLW smiled. Perhaps they will, someday, and some musician on Earth will receive the credit. Well, I hope it will be presented on Earth. HJL rather beyond the most opera goers on Earth, I fancy. JW probably. Still, there is the magic flute. HJL true, but I fancy this is much more occult, and even the magic flute would hardly be considered a popular opera. RLW well, you see what a lot one can do in an Earth day here, and yet synchronize one's time. That's one of the advantages of needing neither food nor sleep. Of course, on the 5th division people will be having Christmas dinners, of a sort, and sleeping off the effects afterwards. Funny, isn't it? We all laughed, and said, well, if it's any consolation for you to know, we haven't had any turkey ourselves this Christmas. This led to conversation about the war, and Mother remarked, it seems to me the world's a very uncomfortable place just now. I am glad I have left it. RLW then began again. Last time I concluded the series of chapters dealing with the officers' organization. I gave you not only a description of how we work, but also typical cases showing the different kinds of experiences men have at death. While I won't say that they cover every case, I do think they cover the majority of men who die in battle. If any striking variants occur to me later, I will give them. At the same time, you might like to glance through them again, and if there are any normal types of men whose death you have not described, mention it and I will find someone who can describe them. JW Of course, most of these were war deaths, but mother shows a long and peculiar illness. Then I have HJL, who was a man of middle age and average type, and the officer, who was a bad type. You have given one or two women killed during the war, so I don't think we need worry about any more examples unless something special crops up. RLW Very good. Now, I have given you the chief crisis in the development of the organization. Since then, though there have been sporadic attempts to organize an opposition, we have never had anything so bad as the great battle in which the spirits of light came to our aid. So I shall give you no more about that subject for a while though, if necessary, I can return to it later. J. W. How's F. RLW still with us? I think we shall hold him now, though he won't be much use for a long time. JW What new theme do you propose? RLW You remember B.S. constant inquiries about fairies, also your own? Well, we have investigated the matter, and I propose to give you several chapters on the subject. Now, very few mortals trouble about the non-mortal beings over here, and so I think you will find that much that I have discovered will be absolutely new to the majority of your readers if you have any. It would be new to most people, even here. Now, as your next visit will usher in a new year, I think it would be a good time to introduce you to a new world, for Fairyland is a new world, differing in many ways from this normal astral world. HJL Well, it's time you returned. So having again wished all three a happy Christmas, and having promised to give similar messages from them to C and B, I turned to go, when RLW called out, "Tell B. The true history of Fairyland begins in the next chapter." We all laughed, and I departed. Chapter 16, Of the Nature of Fairies. December 31, 1917 or January 1, 1918, as soon as I had wished them all a happy new year, at which they laughed, HLJ spoke. We laughed at the idea of a new year, but after all I think we laughed too soon. For what you mean surely is, may this period of your life be better than that which went before, and that is well said. Then RLW began, "I will begin your new year with a subject and its title shall be Fairyland, as promised last time. Now let me begin by saying that at first I thought the only fairies which really existed were those elementals of whom you already know, such as the astral elements thrown off by children, and which took the forms of fairies because of the dreams of little children. But I find there is another order of beings, but few of the earth folk know anything about them. Before describing to you anything about them, I will give a few general deductions I have drawn from what I saw. I think that these beings are souls in the making, spirit beings who have not yet been incarnate on earth. I think when they pass from this plane some, at least, become incarnate in men or animals or flowers. They are of various orders, approximating to the above three types of life on earth, but, as the matter will be clearer after you have heard about my adventures, I will pass on to another point. Their character is very different from ours and yet bears certain traits in common with our own. They are less serious than men and are very irresponsible as a rule. They seem often to be mischievous rather than wicked, but some are undoubtedly hostile to men and actually malevolently inclined towards us, while others are friendly and sympathetic. They have a culture of their own in some points similar to ours, but in others quite different, but this culture varies considerably among themselves. They are seldom serious for long, and are lacking for the most part, in concentration. They combine often in temporary organizations, but quickly forget their original purpose and either scatter again or follow some other whim. They pass from the astral plane like we do, but some depart to the spirit plane, and their astral forms vanish, while others descend to the earth with their astral bodies, and become incorporated in the material envelope which transmutes their former fairy body into an astral body suitable for their new life. Once they have left the astral plane for the earth, they do not return at death to fairyland, but to this portion of the astral plane. Henceforth they are part of the earth, and their development, whether as flowers or man, belongs to the history of our world. What happens to those who go to the spirit plane I cannot yet say. Perhaps later I shall find out. One other point, and then to my narrative. It seems evident that when the fairies become mundane, to a certain extent their progress is thrown back. Probably, however, this is more apparent than real, as it is probable that they acquire new characteristics of which they are in need, and in due course develop in a higher degree those faculties which for a time have been overclouded. At the same time, it is evident that to some extent it is a step backward for a flower fairy to become encased permanently in an earthly flower, to lose its form of movement and individual consciousness, to become inarticulate to a great extent, and so forth. You will understand what I mean more fully when I have finished my narrative. Now to my adventures in Fairyland, Chapter 17. The search for Fairyland, partly because of the constant inquiries of B. about whether there were fairies, and partly because I was myself interested in the subject, I determined to probe the question fully. I therefore began to inquire from everyone I met whether there were fairies here. For the most part, one was laughed at for my pains and told not to be a fool. One or two, however, said they had seen fairies, but on investigation these proved to be only elementals of the type I have spoken of before. I, J.W., then spoke. Yes, I know the sort you mean. W. A. described them fairly completely and gone west. R.L.W. nodded, and went on. At length one man said, "Don't be a fool. If you want to play at being a child, play with children." The idea struck me as being much better than the speaker supposed, so I went into the park where there are always children playing, and began to question all I saw. However, for some time I had no better result. Some of the children laughed at me, as their elders had done, while others said they had never seen any fairies, though they would like to do so. At length, however, I came across two little girls, who seemed to play mainly by themselves, and took little part in the games of the other children. When I asked them my usual question, "Do you know if there are any fairies?" they looked at me shyly, and said, "Yes, but you won't find any here." "Where shall I find them?" apostrophe. I said. "In Fairyland," they replied. "Where is Fairyland?" "We know, but I don't think the fairies would like us to tell you. It's a great secret." For some time I could get no more out of them, but I kept coming back to them, and gradually won their confidence by telling them all the fairy tales I knew. Sometimes they would say, "Yes, that's just like the fairies are." But often they would say, "No, I don't believe fairies ever did that." So at length they agreed to take me into Fairyland, and we set out together. After a while the town was left behind, and we came into fields, and in due course to a wood, where the children led me to a rock overgrown with bushes. Pushing these aside, they showed me the opening of a cave. In the crevices of the rocks were all kinds of ferns. Now the names of the children were Beryl and Joyce. Beryl said, "We go in here." So in we crept, and I found myself in a narrow cave which was so low that I had to stoop. In a short time it grew higher and broader so that I was able to walk upright. Strange to say, it was not very dark, so that we were able to see our way quite plainly. Presently we came to what appeared to be the end of the passage. I saw in front of us nothing but the rock wall of the cave, but Joyce ran her fingers over the surface, and seemed to pull a knob of rock, whereupon part of the rock swung back and revealed a kind of doorway. Through this we passed, and Beryl pulled another knob of rock, which must have moved a lever, for the door closed behind us. We were in quite a large limestone ball, with shining pillars of stalagmite formation. These were white, and the place was lit by a kind of phosphorescent glow. Beryl said, "Isn't it lovely?" But Joyce said, "I think the pink hall is prettier." I was delighted, and said so, but Joyce said, "There are lots of prettier places, as you'll see." I think the palace of the Gnome King must be lovely. We passed across the hall, chatting like this, till we came to an archway, which led us into a pink hall. Here the stalagmite pillars were of a soft rose color, and I quite agreed with Joyce that this was the prettier of the two. Thence we passed through a blue hall,